This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Thank you for coming out on a Friday night to come here to listen to me speak for a while, and then we'll have a time of discussion together. So I'll speak, and when we're done, we're going to have a time of question and response. And at that point, you're free to go whenever you need to. There's no, I won't be offended if you leave early. But again, my name is Joshua Chestnut. The lecture I titled is Revolution or Recession: Sex in Pre- and Post-Christian Cultures. And one of the difficult things about doing a public talk on sex is I am most likely going to offend each and every one of you in some way tonight. It's just the nature of it. I might say something you don't like to hear. But one advantage of speaking about sex in a room like this, in a situation like this, is I don't really need a catchy introduction. You're already here. You're already interested. I don't have to hook you in. But so I'm going to give a fair bit of information tonight, but I want to start with the realization that these should be... Hey, Sean, thanks for coming.
Hi, I'm Sean.
Yeah, that's Sean, everybody. Yep, green shirt, yep. So I want to start by saying these should be booming days for sex, if you think about it. In large part, it's because we are living downstream from a revolution that was waged on our behalf, a revolution to free sex, what's often called the sexual revolution. So British psychiatrist Glenn Harrison calls the sexual revolution the overturning and liberalization of long-established social and moral attitudes to sex that began in Western culture in the 1960s and continues to the present day. And then Catholic thinker Mary Eberstadt, I believe is how you pronounce her name, defines the outcome of the sexual revolution as this. This is the accomplishment, this is the achievement of the sexual revolution. And I put it up here, as well as her name, which I think you say Eberstadt, because we're going to come back to this a couple times. She sums up the effect by saying that it has led to the destigmatization and the demystification of non-marital sex and the reduction of sexual relations in general to a kind of hygienic recreation in which anything goes as long as those involved are consenting adults. So no matter how you tell the story of the sexual revolution, no matter how you hear it, it is a complex story. It's not all bad. It's not all good. And just a heads up, if you're, again, for the people first time here, you might, and those who've been here before might expect this, tonight's talk will be more on the bad side of the sexual revolution. But I want to highlight some of the unexpected fallout, in particular, of this revolution. Those that this psychiatrist Glenn Harrison refers to as the casualties of the revolution. Primarily, I'll be talking about children in that regard. But also, and maybe most surprising, for a revolution that was fought to liberate sex so that sex could be sex, it appears as though one of the casualties of the sexual revolution is sex itself. It might be surprising, but by many accounts, people are having less and less sex today than when the revolution began. So Cambridge professor and statistician David Spiegelhalter, these both are like kind of German-sounding names, and I'm just noticing that myself. But Spiegelhalter writes in his 2015 book, Sex by Numbers, What Statistics Can Tell Us About Sexual Behavior, that when we consider the nature and the rate of the decline in people having sex, he says this, a simple but extremely naive extrapolation would predict that by 2040, the average person will not be having sex at all. He goes on to say, I rather suspect that this will not be the case, but this leaves... Oh, Spiegelhalter. But it leaves the crucial question, why is there going to be less sex? And it begs the question, has the revolution led to a recession? And so that's sort of where we're going to go tonight, looking at some of those things. And we're going to start by looking at what I intend in the subtitle, Pre- and Post-Christian Cultures. What am I after? So before we talk about sex, we're going to talk about cultural theory. Then we're going to look, kind of take a short dive into sex, the conception of sex in a pre-Christian culture in Rome. A brief look then at a Christian vision of sexuality, very brief, very abbreviated. And then we're going to look at sex in a post-Christian culture. And I want to do that by looking at a series of disintegrations of sex. So that's where we're going to go. We're going to cover a lot of ground. But I respect all of you, and I think you can stick with me. We're going to do this. We're going to try to do it in about an hour or less. So we're going to start by talking about pre- and post-Christian culture. So there's all sorts of ways that we can slice the pie on how we got to where we are as a Western culture. And for me, recently, the teaching and writing of an Australian cultural critic, Mark Sayers, in particular, a book of his that those on this side of the room can sort of see, called Disappearing Church. He's introduced me to the thinking of a Jewish sociologist named Philip Reif. Reif taught at the University of Pennsylvania for many decades. He's usually associated as someone who's written a lot on Freud. But he's a very insightful cultural analyst. But he's notoriously difficult to read. Very dense, very academic prose. And Sayers' book, Disappearing Church, in some sense, has worked for me, at least, as a bit of an idiot's guide to the thinking of Philip Reif. And so Reif lays out, his theory is fairly simple, of three eras of Western culture. He calls them creatively... Culture one, wait for it, culture two, and culture three. So those are Reif's distinction. He works kind of looking at the scope of Western history. And so we're first going to talk briefly about first cultures, what he means by first cultures. And these summaries come from Mark Sayers. So first cultures are cultures that believe in many gods. The world is a foreboding place, and the individual is victim to fate. The world is plagued by irrational spiritual forces, and to survive, an individual must obey the taboos of the gods, as well as the broader culture. The world is a frightening, though spiritually charged place. The individual feels besieged by forces beyond their control. So key there is fate and taboos, a spiritual world. We're going to look at an example of this sort of world, a first culture, culture one, when we look at sexuality in the Roman culture in a few minutes. But then he says there's a newer phenomenon, quite a shift, culture two. Second cultures, he says, are scriptural cultures. These are cultures rooted in the Judeo-Christian ethic. They center their entire order on the worship of God. And what's key also here is the universe is arranged in a sacred order. The world makes sense. It's ordered. Taboos are out the window, but instead they're sacred prohibitions or commandments that, when are led to, lead to, and this is central, social justice or human flourishing. In second cultures, God reveals himself through scripture. Religion is creedal, and individuals can find security and peace through obeying God's command. So Reif was something of a secular Jew, but he sort of lumps Judaism and Christianity into this sort of thing, these sorts of cultures. And what Reif is after here is not that these cultures where there was things like justice and human flourishing were ever pervasively realized. There's never a golden era. But these were ideas and animating concepts that were brought in, they were introduced, and they became a goal which people collectively worked towards. Now, a lot of cultural observers have been saying, really for hundreds of years, that as the Western world has secularized, we're reverting. we're going back to look more and more like a first culture as we've lost some of the scriptural bearings of a second culture. So recently, New York Times columnist Ross Douthat has articulated something along these lines. And he brought up a few examples. He talked about how when Brett Kavanaugh was getting confirmed last fall, there weren't just people protesting outside. There were multiple groups of witches that were trying to hex him and curse him. And Douthat also brings up a recent Pew study that shows there are more practicing Wiccans in America today than there are practicing Episcopalians today. It's over 1 million. Yeah, it's crazy. Over 1 million self-identifying Wiccans and about 500,000 people in Episcopal churches every Sunday. So Douthat sees this as we're reverting back. As we let go of the creedal norms of culture two, we're sliding back in to culture one. But according to Reif's analysis, this take has missed something vital. As Western cultures have secularized, they actually haven't regressed back to the culture one form, but they've gone somewhere else entirely. What he refers to very creatively as culture three. So now here's the key about third cultures. Third cultures exist primarily to define themselves over and against the second culture. There is no greater truth in the third culture. They retain a belief in order, but it's not a sacred order, and part of the cultural imperative is to deconstruct all forms of order and expose them as oppressive power grabs. In this sort of culture, there's no creed except heresy, and heresy literally means to choose for oneself. That's what the word heresy means. I choose. And so the primary authority is found within the individual. And nearly all authority which challenges or restricts an individual has to be leveled and removed. So third cultures are constantly in flux. New authorities and rules appear, and then they're deconstructed. So depending on where you sit, depending on where you live in the Western world, you either live kind of in the waning days of a second culture, maybe people are trying to squeeze to hold on to it tight, or you're living in a third culture. And maybe you reside around people that are in a second culture, but your Twitter feed or your Instagram feed is people coming from your like social media diet, your internet intake, is all coming from a third culture. And the insight, and it's worth saying there are some things that it's good that the third culture, the culture we're kind of residing in now, is deconstructing. There's lots of things that were not, that needed to be deconstructed. It's not all bad. But the insight that this division of Western culture, it's sweeping, it's broad, it's admittedly so, it's not, his work deals more in details than I can go into tonight. But what it offers us, and this is the words of Mark Sayers again, is the realization that post-Christian culture is not pre-Christianity. Rather, post-Christianity attempts to move beyond Christianity while simultaneously feasting upon its fruits. Post-Christian culture attempts to retain the solace of faith while gutting it of its costs, commitments, and restraints that the gospel placed upon individual wills. Sayers goes on to say this is a culture bent on disfiguring the second culture while at the same time trying to carry on the Christian project, especially in regards to justice and human flourishing, but having disconnected these concepts from their sources. He summarizes it by saying it's an attempt to build a kingdom, but a kingdom without a king. And so with this very broad, sort of easy, hopefully to remember, very nicely laid out on this slide, I might say, theory of cultures, in particular realizing, I think it's helpful as we begin to talk about sex. And how we conceive of sex today, especially as we reside in either in or near a third culture, which is at the same time parasitic upon a Christian vision of sexuality. It's deconstructing it and working against it. So from this point, with this sort of in place, I want to do a brief jump into a pre-Christian culture, and I'm doing this primarily with the help of historian Kyle Harper in his 2015 book, From Sin to Shame, The Christian Transformation of Sexual Morality in Late Antiquity, Harvard University Press. This is actually, in the world of academic history, this was quite a well-received book, which I've sort of found out after the fact. But the substance of Harper's book is captured in the book's title. The transformation, or what he calls in the book, the first sexual revolution that was brought in the world by the emergence and cultural influence of Christianity. In a culture, the Roman culture, that their message was radically alien to. And the revolution from shame to sin is not simply linguistic. It's not like adding new terms. It's not a psychological shift from outer social judgments to inner personal morality, though that's sort of part of the picture. But it's a change in regards to the horizons of morality and what it means to be a human in the world. He thinks this is one of the biggest tectonic shifts that's happened in Western history, the emergence of the Christian sexual ethic. He goes so far as to argue, which I can't substantiate or I don't really know anything about, but he thinks that our understanding of free will actually emerges from Christian sexual ethics in the first century. We can talk about that in question and answer time. It's a really interesting, big claim. But Harper writes about how shame, going back to the first century, shame was the dominant idea around sexual morality in antiquity. Harper writes that shame was an emotional state experienced by an individual because of the potentially valid disapproval of their moral community. So this is an interpersonal concept. This is what you feel. This is how you experience when you do something wrong in the sight of your community. Harper writes that the demands of honor and shame would vary in the expectations they placed on an individual according to the individual's place within that moral community. So shame is a profoundly social concept, but it's always mediated by gender and by status. What he's after there is not everyone was held to the same sorts of standards when it came to sex. There's no blanket sexual morality in the ancient world at all, but a series of sexual moralities. What you're able to do or what's able to be done to you without bringing shame upon someone in the eyes of the community. And it all depended on where you resided in the social hierarchy. So the bottom of the social hierarchy, we have slaves, very close, you know, moving up, but not too much further up from them, are prostitutes. After prostitutes, you have women. And then slightly above young women, you have noble women, the matron of a home. And finally, at the top, you have free men. Free men reside at the top, and as we'll see, they kind of get away with a lot. So free men were allowed legitimately to to engage in sexual behavior with slaves, with prostitutes, and with boys without bringing shame upon themselves. They were sort of exempt. If anyone's watched or read about the recent series of documentaries on R. Kelly, the surviving R. Kelly documentary, R. Kelly would be like a prototypical normal man in the first century because what he could do. And so here's a quote from a Roman poet who's counseling someone else, who's counseling another man, giving some advice. He says this. His name is Ovid. He says, "If your loins are swollen and there's some homeborn slave boy or girl around where you can quickly stick it, would you rather burst with tension? Not I. I like the easy lay." So that's Ovid speaking about what men are allowed to do in the first century in Rome. And so, but men also were married and were allowed to do this. While they were married, they could still have sex with people in lower places on the social hierarchy. But marriage was the place for respectable reproduction of children, primarily. And it's interesting, women were always virgins. Women who were not shameful, women of honor, were always virgins when they were married. But there's no naturally occurring word in Latin or in Greek for a male virgin. It's just not part, it's not part of their thinking. It doesn't exist. And so Harper said when the writers of the New Testament had to speak about male virgins, they were sort of struggling to kind of make up a new term that would make sense, because it's a radically, radically new thing. And adultery was an act that it's more an act of theft. If you have an affair with someone else's wife, it is their sexual property that you're taking, that they are allowed another man's property. They're allowed to take. There's a historian and kind of a public figure named Dio Chrysostom, who was on record congratulating a young boy who was coming from the brothel, because he said, you made the right choice. You went to the brothel instead of having an affair with another woman, about committing adultery. And I want to read a section from Harper's book just on the nature of how he describes the brothel, which it's worth saying, well, maybe I'll read it first. So he talks about this. The lingering stench, the atmosphere of violence, the cramped concrete cribs, the systemic abuse, these were the reality of the flesh trade. Disease and chemical dependence surely followed in the wake of such exploitive drudgery. The low price of sex in the Roman world is stunning. Sex seems to cost maybe about the price of a loaf of bread. Fellatio cost less. The vile rate of the transaction is also a harrowing indication of the crushing amount of work women had to perform to survive and to profit their owners. The commodification of sex was carried out with all the ruthless efficiency of an industrial operation, the unfree body bearing the pressures of insatiable market demand. In the brothel, the prostitute's body became little by little like a corpse. And Harper goes on to say that to respectable classes, prostitution was not immoral. This isn't a bad thing. This is part of our culture that allows, you know, for swollen loins to sort of find the release of tension. It was squalid. It was a dirty place. It was just a place you didn't want to be. He goes on to say the wealthy had slaves to serve their needs, and it was unnecessary to share sexual receptacles. Prostitution was the poor man's piece of the slave system. So there's a whole lot more. Harper's book is very vivid, but Harper says, again, Paul comes into this world with a radical, unheard of conception of porneia, this Greek word that we often translate as adultery or fornication. You can hear the root there, porneia. It actually is connected to prostitution. It sounds like pornography. But this was a radical idea because it held all people, regardless of where they stood on the social hierarchy, to the same ethic, to the same norm. It could care less as to where one was on the hierarchy. And shame, as a social construct between people, was leveled because all people stood on equal footing before God. Sort of the subtext of this transformation that Harper talks about. He says the transformation went from the city to the cosmos. People no longer just had a place where they followed rules and had moral codes in light of their relationships to other people. They now stood in a universe before God on equal playing fields. This was like unheard of in the ancient world, according to Harper. And so why do you think, when you hear sort of what this world was like, why so many slaves and so many women were attracted to early Christianity and came to the church? It's a place where their bodies were safe, where their bodies were honored and respected, where their bodies had meaning. Harper writes that the legacy of Christianity lies in the dissolution of an ancient system where status and social reproduction scripted the terms of sexual morality. Again, who could and couldn't do what to who? Shame is a social concept instantiated in human emotions. Sin is a theological concept. They represent different categories of moral sanctions. So this is really a different view on what it means to be human and how you treat other humans that Harper is saying the early Christians introduced and really radicalized the ancient world. There's so much more to say. You can find Harper's writing either in this book. Sometimes he writes for First Things or for other academic journals. And he actually has a lot of stuff on his website. He's a really interesting historian. He specializes in slavery and climate change in the ancient world. So very fascinating, fascinating guy, to say the least. He studied just down the road in Harvard. But transitioning briefly and flying over a ton of things and saying far too little about a very important thing, I want to say a few words. I think I would be remiss to not say a few words about a Christian take on human sexuality, the Christian vision of sex. And I'm taking my lead here from Jesus, who, when he's confronted about divorce and remarriage, he brings the question back to Genesis 1. And so I'm going to pull some things from Genesis 1 and 2 and do so kind of because Jesus did so first. And the first thing I want to say in the Christian vision of sex, and I think it's important to also just say that sometimes Christian sexual ethics are presented as a list of rules and prohibitions, do's and don'ts, and I'm not sure that's how we first are encountered by sexuality in the Bible, or sex. So the first thing I want to say is that sex is good. Genesis 1 has this constant refrain of God looking at his world and saying it is good. And this word good in Hebrew, tov, has both the connotations of moral uprightness, but it's also a word of aesthetic pleasure and satisfaction. This is a good, good thing. And think about it. The first command that humans are given in the Bible, the first thing people are told to do is, anybody know? Bible trivia? Nope. Be fruitful and multiply. Yeah, and so part of what's, I think, part of this vision is sexuality. We were sexual before we were sinful. Sexuality and sex are not part of a fallen world necessarily. I mean, they are part of a fallen world, but they were part of God's design for being human. They're not a concession. This got very murky later on in the Christian tradition. Genesis 2 ends with speaking about the first couple being naked and not ashamed. The second thing I want to say, and I think this is quite realistic, sex is very powerful, and it has meaning. Sex does something. In Genesis 2, it talks about the two becoming one. There's something, two humans fusing in this act of sex. And there's these hints, I think echoes, of meaning and significance and transcendence. The word one that's used there is a very important word throughout the Old Testament and to Jewish understanding of spirituality. So the prayer that's prayed is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. The first time we hear that word one is actually speaking about sex. There's something more to sex than just sex, than the exchange of fluids. There's something to it. It's powerful. It brings people together and it points to something more. But at the same time, it's so powerful that you need something to sort of contain and hold this energy. And so that's why it's within the bounds of marriage. It talks about leaving father and mother. So that's why it's in the context of marriage, which in the account is between one man and one woman. Bodies matter to our sexuality. And there's equality between male and female, both made in the image of God. Not men at the top, not women at the bottom, both made in the image of God. And these are the two. This is a controversial thing today. These are the two parts. It's not the right word. Men and women in marriage. Sorry about that. The next I want to say is that sex is generative. Children are a natural consequence of sex. I don't think I need to say much more than that. And the last thing I want to say, moving out of Genesis, but looking at the life of Jesus, is you actually don't need to have sex to live a whole life or to be a whole person. Sex is important, but it's not everything. No, there's a whole lot more to say about a Christian vision of sex. we've got time in the question response to do that. But at this point, I want to now move, and again, this is sweeping, this is big stuff. I want to move to look at the, maybe I'll leave that for a second, to look at the sexual revolution, to look at how sex has become what it is in our post-Christian culture. The sexual revolution is often understood as a liberation movement, freeing sex from all of this sort of baggage to just let sex be sex. But instead, I want to consider it differently. I want to look at it as a series of disintegrations that have taken place. And that's language and the concepts that I'm working with. I'm borrowing from a historian named Sarah Williams. And I do this not so much to make a point that there was ever a golden era, a golden age of human sexuality that we've all fallen from, but just another take, another way of understanding what the sexual revolution has done, coming at it from a different angle. And they're not necessarily building on each other, but the first one I think is very important. So the first disintegration of sex that I want to talk about is sex from procreation. So in our days of easy and effective contraception, legalized abortion, artificial insemination, we can not only have sex without considering children, we can also have children without having sex. I don't think this is an entirely bad thing. We can come back to this again later. But what I'm after with this first disintegration is not just that we can have sex and not worry about an unwanted pregnancy in the same way that someone who's lactose intolerant maybe can eat ice cream, have a lactate, and not worry about a stomach ache. There's something more than that here. There's a historically unprecedented thing. We live in a time where we can think about sex apart from the bearing and the raising of children. We don't think about sex as necessarily entangled with children. And I think this is a very historically unique thing that is contingent upon a lot of technological development. And so this first disintegration has really enabled all the subsequent disintegrations that I want to talk about. What I want to highlight is especially losing this, we see that the revolution, the sexual revolution's vision of sexuality is one that is primarily adult-oriented in the sense that we think about sex as something that is just about adults, about individuals, and it has been removed from the consequence of having children or being part of a family. That's the first one. The second one I want to talk about is from marriage. And I'll warn you, I'm going to camp out here for a little while. But non-marital relationships are commonly imagined as the perfectly legitimate context for sex and the creation of family today. Two sociologists, Mark Regnerus and Jeremy Uecker, in their book Premarital Sex in America, claim that 95% of Americans of all ages have had sex outside of marriage. And they also show an often cited statistic that 40% of all births in the U.S. today happen outside of marriage. So 40% of kids are being born out of wedlock. And just a little context, in the 1950s, it was 6%. So it's been quite a drastic increase. Now, and as we've eased the parameters in which sex is an acceptable thing, if we dig deeper into some of these numbers, we can see how this disintegration of sex from the commitment of marriage has had some unintended fallout, which disproportionately affects poorer, less educated communities, and in particular, birth mothers and children. So in the 1970s, 20% of out-of-wedlock births were to women with only a high school diploma or less. 20%. Yet today, the number has risen to just shy of 70% of all out-of-wedlock births. So reflecting on this growth, Harvard sociologist Robert Putnam is concerned that too often mothers with less education have significantly less access to the social and financial resources which enable them to navigate the very difficult and important work of raising children. They do so also often apart from the presence of a father. Now, the majority of these out-of-wedlock births have happened in cohabitating couples. What we might think of as the definitely maybe approach to relationships. It's becoming... Thank you for laughing. I feel like we needed a joke or needed some laughter. It's becoming a more common experience for those contemplating marriage and family and who see that commitment is a serious, serious thing. It's an arrangement where two partners live together in order to see how compatible they are, both relationally and sexually, before some sort of long-term commitment. So cohabitation is often presented as a realistic and prudent move, a try-before-you-buy approach to love and marriage, which on the surface makes a lot of sense, especially for a cynical generation that has seen a lot of really terrible, broken marriages. That said, nearly all of the evidence undermines this seemingly wise counsel. Less than 1 in 5 cohabitating couples end up getting married, and Regnerus and Euchre, again from their book Premarital Sex in America, said that those that do get married, cohabitating significantly increases the likelihood of an eventual divorce. This mirrors the conclusion of a joint 10-year study between Princeton University and the Brookings Institution, which is called The Future of Children. You can find it online. I think it's like www.princeton.futureofchildren.org. And they refer to cohabitating relationships as, on the whole, very unstable and refer to it as a fragilized family environment for children. I want to say a few more words about cohabitation, or at least some common words that are used that I sort of have a problem with. So this is coming from me, not from professional sociologists. I got a problem with the words compatibility and partners. These are words that have crept into our discourse about relationship, and they bring with them unhelpful conceptions that I'm not convinced are, on the whole, helpful. So the first one, compatibility. Now, it's, of course, wise to get to know someone, to take note of their character, their past, their interests, their friends, their family, before getting serious with them. But I think there's a problem. This process is being called compatibility, looking to see if we're compatible. But this is a word, compatibility, that has migrated from the realm of mechanics into the realm of relationships. And it brings with it, kind of sneaks in, a different conception of how humans do or do not relate to one another. Compatibility, again, is mechanical language, initially mechanical language, technological language to describe the manner in which how one computer or one piece of software does or does not work with another piece of software or another computer. There's nothing dynamic about compatibility. There's nothing adaptable about compatibility. It works or it doesn't work. This is not the case with human beings. We are dynamic. We are mysterious. We're changing. We're adaptable creatures. We play a role in what the course our relationships with others are going to take. So I think compatibility is a well-intended word. It's intended to make us aware that humans are different from one another, and we see things differently. But I think it sneaks in this conception that I am this way and you are that way, and that's all that there is to it. This is not how humans relate. The second linguistic creep is from, well, not like creep verb, not like a noun like you creep. Anyway, is from spouse to the more politically inclusive term partner that I used before. Partner is borrowed from the realm of economics, and it suggests that an exchange is taking place where choice and autonomy are paramount, with the intention of maximizing profits and minimizing losses. This is hard because relationships are not as easy to quantify as quarterly reports are. What holds business partners together are contracts. You sign a contract. But cohabitation sort of has a similar sort of contract to it, a romantic contract. As long as we love each other and feel these romantic feelings towards each other, we're going to stay together. But if we fall out of love, it's time to close up shop. It's time to move on to something new. And this contract, this romantic contract, I think is policed by our culture's most esteemed virtue of all, authenticity. In the name of authenticity, a partner is not only allowed, but is compelled, right? Compelled to leave a loveless relationship. Or these differences are irreconcilable. We are going to consciously uncouple, in the annoying words of Chris Martin and Gwyneth Paltrow from a few years back. Can I get a hear-hear on that? Anybody remember that? Oh, I want to bang my head and both of them against the wall. Right. This is seen as something that's honest, as admirable, and as brave by the couple that chooses to leave this loveless marriage and not work through it. In large part because fidelity in our wider culture has been reinterpreted as truth and commitment not to another person nor to one's children, but to oneself. I owe this much to myself to end this unhappy marriage. Again, this often happens with little consideration to the overwhelming amount of research on how destructive divorce can be for children. Again, an individualized, an adult-oriented vision of sexuality, I think, is behind some of these changes in our culture. And of course, it's not just cohabitating couples who split. No-fault divorce, which was initially introduced in this country by the then governor of California and icon of conservative politics, Ronald Reagan. It's offered an easy way out of difficult or undesirable marriages. And has, in the words of one sociologist, enabled and institutionalized and normalized a father's absence from the lives of his children. So the previously mentioned study by Princeton University and the Brookings Institution, The Future of Children, concluded by saying this: most scholars now agree that children raised by two biological parents in a stable marriage do better than children in other family forms across a wide range of outcomes. It also states that reams of social science and medical research convincingly show that children who are raised by married biological parents enjoy better physical, cognitive, and emotional outcomes on average than children who are raised in other circumstances. End of quote. And I'm not trying to say that children of divorce or out-of-wedlock births are fated. There's nothing they can do about it. I'm trying to bring this up to show those who experience the unintended fallout of the sexual revolution's vision of free human sexuality from marriage, time and time again, have been children. And so this might sort of seem tangential, maybe, or soapboxy to a lecture on sex, but we see here that the cultural disintegration of sex from marriage as the legitimate place for sex, which is by its nature bound up with the bearing and raising of children, has had disproportionate and highly negative effects upon children. Children are without a doubt the ones left behind by the revolution. We could say more, or I could say more, and I'm sure you could as well, but we're going to move on. And this one is a bit of a hot button at the moment. There is a raging culture war. The next disintegration is from the sexes. Sex from the sex. Sex disintegrated from the sexes. And I'm actually not going to speak too much about this, but I think it's worth naming that for our social imagination about sex, it no longer matters whether it's male or female, who this is. We can come back to this in our question and answer time. I'm happy to. I just don't want to give the impression that I can explain people's sexual orientation or their attraction. I'm just mostly describing something that's new and unique in our culture that has happened very quickly. So we're going to move on from this disintegration. And I want to talk about from partnership. So the disintegration of sex from partnership. We've moved further down. What I have in my mind here is hookup culture, Tinder. There's a common narrative that one, and particularly men, must pass through a season of casual sex before settling down. And with this disintegration of sex from partnership, the connection between intimacy and sex has dissolved. Sex is no longer considered a means to establish intimacy, unless you want it to establish intimacy. And often, if it does establish intimacy, at least in one of the partners in this casual sex, there's a problem, right? If someone gets connected to someone else through something like this, this is like the setup for sitcoms or for like, I don't know, like maybe not romantic comedies, but I don't know, those sorts of movies. Something has gone wrong. And with this disintegration, sex has been domesticated and placed within the category of recreational, private affair between two adults, so long as it's done hygienically or safely. This sounds like the words of our Roman friend Ovid, who encouraged them not to let their loins swell, but is looking for an easy lay. It's like scratching an itch, taking care of a physical sensation. But interestingly enough, the little research that I was able to find, sex within hookups actually appears to be less pleasurable than sex with a long-term partner. So Kate Julian, in her Atlantic cover story, The Sex Recession, we'll come back to it in a little bit, cites one study which found that 31% of men and only 11% of women reached orgasm during a hookup. You contrast that with sex within a relationship, where 84% of men did and 67% of women did. So the research that's being done is even showing that sex in hookup culture is often not even good sex. And so the final disintegration of sex that I want to speak about is from a partner. This is essentially dehumanized sex. And maybe you've heard about this through a recent rise in a clinical diagnosis of porn-induced erectile dysfunction. This is where porn addicts have so conditioned themselves and in the process rewired their brains by viewing and masturbating to internet porn that they become unable to be aroused by another person, even if that person was their partner who they'd previously been aroused by. An especially sort of sad, but I think worth mentioning instance of this comes from the book Modern Romance by the disgraced, now disgraced comedian Aziz Ansari. There's some really interesting things in the book. But in one part of the book, he travels to Japan to learn firsthand about their relationship replacement industry. An industry, by its name, you know what it's doing. It's replacing relationships. And one of the saddest, most depressing moments in a sometimes humorous, but actually often very depressing book on modern romance. Ansari talks about Tenga. And Tenga is a multi-million dollar company which specializes in making masturbation devices like a single-use silicone egg that men fill with lubricant and masturbate inside. Ansari comments sympathetically about the users that they're interested in sexual pleasure, just not interested in achieving it through the traditional routes. Traditional routes being another person. Ansari gets one himself, uses it, he finds it cold and unappealing, but he writes this. He says he sees how it was a way to avoid putting yourself out there and having an experience with another person. Masturbation has been around as long as people have been around. There's something that's profoundly not new here. But there's a sense with Ansari's comment about at the end there, a way to avoid putting yourself out there and having an experience with another person. That is slightly, there's something new about that. That's somehow legitimate and not shameful. I looked at the social media account, the Instagram account, of the company that makes these eggs. And this is not a, like, these are not nerdy guys in the basement. Like, it's, you see these beautiful women and these attractive men holding eggs and other things in these, at parties. I don't need to say much more. Don't look at it. I'm not sure why. Anyway. But I want to get back to Mary Eberstadt's definition on the achievement of the revolution. The destigmatization and demystification of non-marital sex and the reduction of sexual relations in general to a kind of hygienic recreation in which anything goes so long as those involved are consenting adults. And maybe we could cross out the last S and say as long as they are a consenting adult. And when I wonder whether or not people can live with this vision and this take on sexuality long. I what comes to mind for me is, has anyone seen A Beautiful Mind with Russell Crowe? There's a scene where he's in a bar and he walks up to this blonde woman. He's very sweet. He's kind of awkward. And they're looking at each other, and she's waiting for him to say something. And he says, can we just pretend that I said whatever I needed to say for us to have sex together? Can we skip the conversation and go right to the intercourse? He says, to the intercourse. It's very, very awkward. And he says, it's not a big deal. It's essentially about fluid exchange. And he looks at her, and she has this bewildered look on her face. And then she slaps him. And she walks away and calls him an asshole. And there's something about that. Like, she refused to live with that take on it. And it seems as though she's not alone. When this is all that sex is, it seems as though people want something more. As I said at the outset, these should be booming times for sex. But instead, it seems as though there's something of a generational cold shower, or a cultural cold shower. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, their Youth Risk Behavior Survey, found that from 1991 to 2017, high schoolers having sex dropped from 54 to 40%, and that teen pregnancy is on a steep decline. Now, in and of themselves, these might be good signs, good things we should celebrate, kids not making bad mistakes. But Kate Julian, in her cover story to The Atlantic, The Sex Recession, which is there, you can also find some of this information in two other books, A Better Story by Glenn Harrison, and a poorly named but very insightful book called Divine Sex by Jonathan Grant. It's just an odd name. But Julian reads this about teens having less sex and wonders if this is the first indication of a broader withdrawal from physical intimacy that extends well into adulthood. Jean Twinge, the author of iGen and a professor of psychology at San Diego State, notes that the average adult in the U.S. had sex 62 times a year in the 90s, and it's dropped to 54 times by 2014. Anthropologist Helen Fisher, who has a really fascinating TED Talk. If you're a TED Talk person, look up Helen Fisher. She co-directs and leads Match.com's annual Singles in America survey. And she says that year after year, the whole Match.com company is rather staggered at how little sex Americans are having, including millennials. In the article, Julian goes on to say that when she talked to experts, when she talked to people looking into this, she was told that the recession might be the consequence of any of the following things: hookup culture, crushing economic pressures, surging anxiety rates, psychological frailty, widespread antidepressant use, streaming television, environmental estrogens leaked by plastics, dropping testosterone levels, digital porn, the vibrator's golden age, dating apps, option paralysis, helicopter parents, careerism, smartphones, the 24-hour news cycle, information overload, generally speaking, sleep deprivation, and obesity. She goes on to say, name a modern blight and there is someone somewhere ready to blame it for messing up the modern libido. So there's all of that. But as sex has been stripped of its mystery, of its power, of its natural connection to bearing children in the context of commitment and intimacy, it's actually become a highly performative and competitive consumer product. It just might not be worth people's time. This conception of sex simultaneously asks people to base their whole identity on it, about how many people you've had sex with, or the best sex you can have. But at the same time, it asks people to trivialize that, because it's saying there's always someone else. Maybe there's always a new thing just on the horizon. So I have a few concluding thoughts, and this is a word to other people that have an investment, which I'm not assuming necessarily anyone or some of you here, I don't know you all, but people who have an investment in the Christian vision of sexuality, a few things to say. I think we need to be very aware that this series of disintegrations is completely misunderstood if it is understood as a move away from morality to immorality. That's not the case. It's moved to a very different sort of morality. I think a helpful way of getting into this, or a helpful resource in general, comes from the evolutionary psychologist Jonathan Haidt, who used to teach at UVA, but now is, I think, at NYU, in his book, The Righteous Mind. And it's worth your time. It's a big book. It's not actually really about sex at all. It's about why good people are divided about politics and religion, just like the subtitle says. But his argument, a part of his argument, is really trying to say we're driven by our intuitions. And our intuitions are formed by different sort of moral matrices. He says we live in a particularly weird culture, historically speaking. And both weird in the sense of what you hear, but he also means weird as meaning Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. These are all actually fairly unique things. And one of the things he does is he looks at how people respond to moral problems. Their intuitions are shaped by what he says are different moral taste buds or moral foundations. If you can see the slide, it's helpful. If not, maybe it's not that helpful. But he comes up with six sort of taste buds. And he calls these moral matrices either care and harm, liberty and oppression, fairness or cheating. And he tends to say those on the liberal side, which would include himself, these are the main moral matrices by which they're appraising, by which their intuitions are evaluating almost immediately moral issues. Again, care or harm, is anybody being hurt? Liberty or oppression, are you putting anyone down? Fairness or cheating, is there inequality here? But then he says, on the other side, there's more moral foundations, which he tends to see as conservative. He actually says conservatives use all six moral taste buds. But the others are loyalty or betrayal, authority and subversion, or sanctity or degradation. And he's saying that historically our culture has spent time over here when thinking about contentious moral issues, being loyal. These are more community-based. Are we loyal to the people we're around? Are we being faithful to authority? And then answering questions, are things sacred? Is there a sacredness to things? But he said Western cultures, these weird cultures, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic, are mostly working with these moral foundations, care and liberty, and then fairness. And so when people look at what the sexual revolution has accomplished, it's not just to the lack of a moral vision where everything's cool, everything's great. There's actually a very real moral foundation that a lot of people have that people are swimming in. People, like, this is where the world is. We can come back to this. But I think we have to be aware that sort of this disintegration, as our culture has changed, it's not away from morality to immorality. It's to a new form, a very different form of morality. And there's good things there, too. I think some of these things come from the Christian faith, post-Christian culture, feasting on the fruits of a Christian culture, as we said a while ago. The second thing, I think, is we need to learn to listen well to people. You've all practiced that very well this evening. Proverbs 18:13 says, "If one gives an answer before he hears, it is his folly and shame." And so if we want to speak effectively about a Christian vision of sexuality, we need to listen. We need to understand the world that our neighbors, our friends, our children, the world they live in, what they're experiencing, what their story is. We need to be people who listen. Because I think many times people think Christians hate them. And that Christians look down their nose at people and think they're better than people, other people. That we're somehow upright. The next thing I think we need, I want to go back to Rife's three theories of culture. If you remember 1, 2, and 3. One of the things through the history of missions, of the missionary movement is we've learned is bad is the process of colonialization. That when people from culture two, from a Christian culture, have moved to pre-Christian cultures, they've brought with them unnecessary kind of cultural things that they've wrapped up with and confused with the Christian faith. But I think as we move into a third culture, we need to also be aware that the third culture actually colonizes us, right? That their vision of sex is actually very appealing in many ways, and it makes a lot of sense to people. And so we need to be aware that the third culture is not just a place we go to, but it's coming to us. It's shaping us as we stream whatever we're streaming on Netflix, right? As we listen to music, as we talk to people, it shapes our assumptions about things. The last thing I want to say is if there is fallout from the revolution, both the revolution itself, but the culture war that's surrounding all of these very, very contentious issues, Christians and churches might well consider reimagining themselves, not so much as a battalion of warriors who are going to take over a culture and win a culture back, but instead, and this is an image from Pope Francis, to think of themselves, to think of us as a field hospital. Pope Francis says this, "It's useless to ask a seriously injured person if he has high cholesterol and about the level of his blood sugars. You first have to heal his wounds, then we can talk about everything else. Heal the wounds, and you have to start from the ground up." There's a lot of people that have felt a lot of fallout from the sexual revolution. Unintentionally so. There's a lot of victims who've grown up in this world. And there's people who are hurting. And I think the church would be wise, we would be wise as people to, instead of just jumping into a scripted culture war, to listen to people, to care for people, to help heal them where they are. And so I have talked for longer than I thought I would, and you have listened very well. So thank you. And I'm going to turn it over to you. If you need to leave for whatever reason, you're free to leave. But I'm happy to talk about any of the things I've said or not said, because there's lots of things that have been gone unsaid about this. Let's have a conversation. Take your time. I'm going to eat a cookie.
We'll wait till your mouth's full before we ask you.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Clark.
Josh, did Spiegel, Sex by the Numbers author,
Spiegelhalter,
the other people who were writing about this decline, didn't they talk about the effect of HIV? I remember that being huge when I was young.
It's definitely overlooked if it is, yeah. Kate Julian, I don't think, talks about it. And I think in part because of how people think of contraception now, and
right. Yeah.
But I mean, because there's been since then too, like there's been such a push for safe sex. Right.
Implicit in that is that sex is dangerous.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, there's consequences to it, right? Yeah, especially. But no, I mean, not really. That was not. No, that was not front and center. And I actually really didn't think about that much until right now when you said that. Yeah. Yeah, Joyce.
Well, this is a clarification question.
Yeah.
When you talk about the Christian vision of sex, mm-hmm. I know you had a lot to go through, so you went over it kind of quickly. You mm-hmm. mentioned that we were sexual before we were sinful. And mm-hmm. Paul, could you go over that a little more? And your thoughts on that?
Yeah, sure. I just, so there's been all sorts of takes on sexuality in the Christian tradition, and there's been a lot of influential voices, especially early on, that have said sex is sort of an unnecessary, well, sex is sort of a concession, and it's not really a good thing. And so I was just trying to say that it seems as though in the picture of sexuality, the vision of sexuality in Genesis, that's not actually the case. It seems like it's something that's built in to the nature of the world. And that, like, it's a good thing. And so sort of the story of the Bible is often sort of summarized as there's creation, and there's the fall, and then redemption, and then restoration. It's not always the most helpful way, because it's very simple, but like, sex shows up prior to the fall. It's not just some sort of, again, some sort of concession that happens later. Does that make any more sense? Or not
like
so much?
Sex shows up, like, while they were in the Garden of Eden, or?
Well, or just the picture there. I mean, it doesn't... it's not record. I mean, it's not necessarily recorded. I'm just saying that it's. You go back to the first commandment. The first thing people are told that's part of this cultural mandate to sort of take care of the world. Part of that is to be fruitful and multiply. And so, part of being human is being sexual. So being sexual is not a bad thing. Does that make sense? I'm just. Tell me if I need to say more, if anything's not.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I agree with you on the second part. I was just kind of confused on the phrasing, we were sexual before we were sinful. Because that like, I guess, like, during Adam and Eve, during before.
Just like the vision of humanity that's there. I mean, there's all sorts of ways to slice the pie of Adam and Eve. Were they historical characters? And they were to some extent. And, like, I don't necessarily want to walk through... I'd be happy to maybe later, since you're here for a while, we could have a cup of tea and talk about it.
Actually, perhaps speaking as opposed to, like, there's some other religions which say, like, the original sin was sex. I think there's some African tribes that that's...
Yeah, well, not necessarily, but just, like, being a person, being in a body, and being sexual is sort of how things were intended. Humans... Sexuality isn't this bad thing that comes later so that we can continue on in some way. Is that still tell me if it's not making any, feel free to say more, but, or not. Marty has her hand up.
Well,
yeah.
I just, when you said that, I was thinking, in contrast, some of the early church fathers, I mean, very early, Jerome and various other churches,
yeah.
even Augustine had, you know, this idea that sex was fallen, that sort of the fall was sex itself, you know, and that it was a concession to reproduction. But I mean, Augustine teaching that no one should have sex from desire, but simply because of the need to reproduce children. And that, so I was thinking that mm-hmm. obviously is a contrast of what happened quite early.
Yeah.
A really
negative
view of sexuality coming into the church quite early.
Mm-hmm. Having a dose of Greek philosophy, not reading the Bible faithfully.
Mm-hmm.
Right, exactly.
Hi, what's your name?
I'm Alex.
Hi, Alex.
My first time.
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you for the lecture tonight. Mm-hmm. Do you mind expressing your opinions on contraception in marriage?
Mm-hmm. No. I do mind. No, I'm just kidding. I have respect for the when we were first married, before we were married, or maybe right after we were married, we took a class on natural family planning, the Serena method, is that what it was called? No contraception whatsoever. It was a class we took. I'm not exactly sure. I think our friends were taking it. That's why we took it. Is that the?
We did. We all took it together.
We did take it together. I don't think the use of contraception in a marriage is always wrong or bad. I think sort of the institution of marriage needs to be open to having children, like, because it's part of one of the one of the consequences of sex, but I don't think each and every sexual act needs to, if that makes sense. I see it as sex fits within the context of marriage, and that marriage has to be open to children, on a Christian take on this. But I don't think every single time of having sex has to be open towards that end, but I think the institution of marriage does. Any other thoughts? Okay.
No, that was fine.
Yep. Thank you. Yeah. Anyway. Marty has her hand up again.
I thought of the passage in James that talks about planning is applying, when James says, when you make plans, don't plan with arrogance, saying, we're going to go here, we're going to go there, I'm going to get this degree, I'm going to go get this job, and so on. But rather, plan. Planning is not wrong, but plan with humility and openness. And I've understood, because sex is described in the Bible as not only being for the purpose of procreation, mm-hmm. but for union, this mysterious union, and for pleasure. Mm-hmm. And all of that is part of what God intended in marriage. And so we've always understood the planning as being legitimate, but with an openness. Mm-hmm. So we plan, but not with arrogance. We use contraception, but sometimes it doesn't work. We actually have a couple of children where the contraception didn't work. And we say, thank you, God. These are your gifts. It was your intention, so we're open to... Anyway, that's how I've one of the ways we've understood it.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, Jeff. Really? I just think of your big movements here, and if I'm getting it right, pre-Christian culture, the people who seem to suffer the most in the sexual realms or in the area of sex were women and children, it seems. And now...
And slaves. I didn't want to talk about it, because Harper spends a lot of time with, pederasty as well. Quite a bit of pages, but I just didn't... Yeah, but yeah.
And then it seems that something of that comes back as we move into a post-Christian culture. So, you mentioned, the kids suffer the most with what's going on. And then you mentioned a bit of women. Are there studies on how maybe women suffer more in this post-Christian culture than men do sexually? At least the stories I hear, that seems to be more the case. But I was just wondering if is that in the studies at all?
Some of it, especially with... no-fault divorce and with out of wedlock and cohabitation, that more times than not, it's men who get out of the responsibility. Not exclusively, but so in that sense. But, I just went more for looking at... I started reading this, The Future of Kids, the future of children, where there was just a lot of concern about sort of the fallout. But, I mean, I think certainly, because, I mean, even, I think it always has been and continues to be pre-sexual revolution, during the, I mean, part of the reason why I didn't really like the idea of a Christian culture and that sort of thing, it sort of doesn't work, because it's like, I mean, women were treated terribly for, and so were children, and so were men. You know, there was never this ideal, like, golden age that we've fallen from. I think what I was trying to do was highlight, like, what to me, the more I read, was sort of seeing an unexpected fallout of the sexual revolution. But I do think it always has been easier for men, and I'm not sure the sexual revolution has, I mean, again, it's a complex story, so you can look at it through different lenses, because in a lot of ways, women have been way more, at least empowered in the last 30, 40 years in our culture, or at least they there's more of a voice, but I still think it, they bear a consequence of sex in their bodies, either that men don't. It's hard to get away from that. But yeah, you, Mary Frances?
Yeah, I thought about this when you were talking, this ties into what Dave said. It's not exactly what you're talking about, Dave, but I think just thinking about sexual harassment, sexual assault, women, minorities, children, immigrants, I mean, any sort of minority population is at a much, much, much higher risk of sexual harassment and sexual assault, and they're at a higher risk and they are victims of that. Certainly other men are as well, but to a disproportional rate, those sort of same category, you know, just people with less power, so however you want to define that, whether that's less power in the workplace, less power in a relationship, less power physically, I mean, whatever, however you want to divide that out. So it's not what you're asking about, like how does it line up in the culture, but I think we're still seeing that played out in that arena.
Hey, Tom.
Yeah. I'm not sure how this fits with, I'm thinking about the three cultures you pointed out. There seems to be one of them missing. The second culture talked about scriptural, you know, having rules. Mm-hmm. And that was, in some other places, that's called the ancient age, where truth comes from authority. You know, God, the Bible, Aristotle, whatever. Whatever is accepted as authority, that's where truth comes from. Then there was the modern age, where the scientific age, where truth came from reproducible experiments. But there's still a truth out there that could be known, known by anybody. You didn't have to listen to an authority, but you did have to reproduce the result. And then there's the postmodern age, which has more to do with that level three of deconstructionism, of how you personally perceive it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how these. I'm not sure how that fits in, but that just stuck out. That jumped out at me as something missing.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't think it's the only way to slice the pie, or the and I mean, even sort of the division between is postmodernity really just hypermodernity? Is it sort of modernity on steroids? Like, is it that did it actually start more in modernity and just kind of go a little crazy? So there's, I don't disagree with what you're saying. I don't think it's the only way to make sense of our cultural moment. It's so broad, you know, it's so sweeping. But I just sort of found it, to me it was helpful to think about, at least sort of what I found helpful was Sayer's sort of analysis, where we're moving, like this idea of a kingdom without a king, like we're moving on, we're taking some of the good and we're running with it. I think the simplicity of that, anyway, but keep going.
Well, I was going to say that perhaps two could be split into, his second culture could be split into two. One was first the truth came from authority, from a human authority or a God authority, The second one was truth came from science. Truth came from the scientific, something still outside yourself.
Yeah.
Rather than self-referential.
Yeah.
And then by postmodernism, you have is how you personally perceive it. But I'm sort of wondering what that might have to do with sexuality, because there are studies now that are closer to, you know, scientific, where they say, watch out, don't hook up, because you look what's going on in your brain, and you say, you might start out as just pure lust, but you're going to find yourself bonding chemically.
Yeah.
And so there are these hardwired consequences.
Yeah. Can you remind me of your name?
Yeah, my name's Steve.
Hey, Steve.
I just wonder if in that third culture, maybe if in the second culture, authority was, say, God or maybe science and reason, that kind of thing. In this latest culture, it seems like the authority is the individual.
Yes.
And so maybe it's not that we have no king or kingdoms, I figure exactly what you said, but maybe we have maybe too many kings, each individual. So I guess it leads me to a question. Would you say that not every culture has kind of reached this third culture, that less...
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah,
hasn't
yeah.
really gotten there yet and maybe won't.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I just, yeah, and again, I just found this sort of a tool to sort of cut up Western history sort of into sweeping ways and sweeping eras. But, there's still cultures that are first cultures that still haven't really been Christianized or had, you know, all of those things come into them. So, and your question was, are there still second cultures? Or just the...
I think you're right that there are first cultures. Yeah. I just wonder, you know, to what extent we'll see cultures kind of transform. Perhaps we won't, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, he uses the language of cultures because there's... I mean, even ones that are so similar, like Western cultures, even as you start... You can find different differences between, or significant differences between cultures that share a lot of same base assumptions about the world and human dignity, or, I mean, just between European countries and American countries, or American countries, American cities or whatever, urban centers. So, yeah, anyway, I don't know if that answered your question or not, but yeah. Yes, sir.
So this might be a strange question, but I'm wondering what kind of spurred this lecture. Was it the Atlantic article, or?
Yeah.
A little bit about the process of.
The Atlantic article, and then, I've done four lectures here on, or three lectures here on pornography, which is an issue about sex. And I just wanted to do some more reading, teaching, and thinking about it. I mean, I felt like I wanted to learn more. I guess I was very surprised. And the Atlantic article is sort of what started it.
I'm just curious because I'm just wondering if it's widespread because in that thought of that article, I'm wondering how widespread that is because. Something like, you know, the bachelor being a virgin, that seems to be like an outcast of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like, I feel like I'm kind of tossed in between those two ideas.
Yeah. I mean, it does sort of cut against what we assume when we, like, watch TV or go on social media or... and there are sort of scripted norms. But, I mean, it's interesting. One of the things she cites is places where there was a study that where broadband internet showed up, or like fast internet. Is that broadband internet? Is that broadband internet? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, you got it.
Okay, thanks, Sean. where that showed up, there was soon a decline in teen pregnancy. So it does seem, and that the studies happen like, and both in Japan and then in European countries and then in parts of the U.S. So it seems as though it's happening, like, I forget what her I want to just quote the exact line how it's said, but yeah, the indication of a broader withdrawal from physical intimacy that extends well into adulthood. I mean, she talked about how, I think it was her, or it might have been somewhere else, where contractors who are building homes are now, especially large homes, are building separate bathrooms because people are it's a more common practice for the master bedroom not to have one shared bathroom, but two separate bathrooms, like a his and hers bathroom. She talked about how contractors are also finding gyms, like gyms are being remodeled because younger people don't want to change in front of like other people. There's just a general, which is like, I'm very sympathetic with that. Like, I don't like being at the gym in the, I'm not at the gym that much. I have been there. But like, I like the privacy, but I've just always thought of it as like, well, this is just the nature of the beast. But that as, like, gyms that have, like, growing memberships with younger people are ones that sort of cater to more privacy, less sort of shared public spaces where there's older. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. I'm not knocking that. It's just sort of an indication on a surprising not shyness, but just people wanting to stay to themselves. I don't think it's necessary. It's not all bad or wrong. It's just, again, an unexpected, outcome.
People would be even more comfortable with being a body in front of bodies.
Yeah.
If sex is demystified, and that Mary Eberstadt quote, and yet there seems to be more shame, more self-consciousness.
Yeah, I think because we see more bodies, and the bodies we see are like not our bodies, they're perfect bodies, and so, yeah, we tend to then feel more shame about our own bodies. I think, but yeah, Dick.
Yeah, I'm really interested by your question of the difference between the Atlantic article and the. Still, it seems to me, I mean, I'm not a great student of media, but a triumphal view of sex throughout the culture.
Yeah.
The advertising, I mean, in part because there's billions to be made still with the triumphal view of sex.
Yeah.
You can sell anything. As I was going to say, you can sell snow tires.
Yeah.
On sex.
Yeah.
And it, with the right sort of advertising.
Yeah.
And so... I think there's going to be reluctance to conceding what that article is saying.
Yeah.
To admitting it to... You're trying to bring a kind of a... Let's have some reality to this in the midst of this apparently triumphal revolution.
Yeah.
It's not really... Well, what's his name? Glenn Harrison is... That's his angle. But it's interesting to me what stands against admitting that or seeing it or recognizing it.
Yeah.
It's a huge investment in the triumphal view of the sexual.
And I think, like, they'll continue to sell, whether or not people are, like, that continues to sell and be something people partake in, whether or not they're actually finding intimacy or kind of the courage to go to the bar and, you know, find somebody. So I do think, I mean, it does sound fairly counterintuitive to what you would assume things are like out there, but I can't remember, if it was this, if it was that article, or there's a few years ago, there was a Vanity Fair article on Tinder, and if you're having a bad day, don't read this article, and if you're having a good day, also don't read this article, because it is super depressing. So, like, just on an okay day, you should read it. But, I mean, it was talking very, it was interviewing a lot of people about how hookup culture just, like, isn't worth it, and people the article ends the woman who wrote it is at a sorority, and it's Sunday midday, they're having brunch, and the women are just laughing at the thought of like ever having an orgasm with a man, because men are just, I mean, because of the whole, the nature of hookup culture, like it's just not in their conception of what's sort of available to them. And I think as people see that and experience that, I think people are like, what's the point? Like, I'll take an egg, you know? And like, yeah, it was really interesting, like, in Aziz Ansari book, where he actually writes it with a sociologist who teaches at NYU, so it's not just like a funny book. There is some research in it. But, like, Japan is having this rapid population decline, where there are government incentives for you to go out and meet somebody and get married and have kids, because birth rates are dropping, have dropped crazy. And there's this whole culture of men that they refer to as grass-eating men, which is not a nice thing to be called. And it's just it's a growing culture of men who, like, they stay inside, they go to work, they come home, they play video games, and do other things online, but there's no interest. Like, there's no interest in going out. There's no interest even in hookup culture, like, if it was available. And so there's this marked decline. And the sociologist that Kleinenberg is his name, he wrote Going Solo, if anyone's heard of Going Solo, it's about loneliness. But he teaches at NYU. He talks about how for years the Western world has looked at Japan and said, well, that's not us, that's just Japan. But now most Western cultures are saying, oh, maybe it's not just Japan. Maybe it's actually, maybe there's something in this modern world that's actually working against people being intimate and people, and it's unexpected because, like you said, we should be more open. We should be more triumphant and celebratory and open to all these things, but people are just not finding the courage to go out there, and meet someone and do something. Cause why not just stay? I don't know. I'm just sort of rambling here a little bit, but Audrey, yeah, were you going to say something?
Yeah. I noticed this last year when I was walking through BU's Barnes & Noble around Valentine's Day, and I noticed a lot more books. I was reading the books, but about, you know, how to be creative with sex. So I've noticed things like, oh, you can do sex in all different kinds of ways, how to be a smart polyamorist, and detailed. The books are almost scientific in how you can have a non-monogamous ethical relationship.
Yeah.
and then I've gone on Guardian, like on the Guardian there are articles about how I'm so happy going to like sex parties with my husband and like, you know, this other level of, you know, maybe the meaning and the power of sex somehow in the way that it's been disintegrated, people who have a lot of time on their hands are finding ways to try and make it more interesting.
Hmm. I mean, I wonder if some of that is part of it's sort of a selective part of the population, and maybe it's not, what's that?
Not everyone.
No, not everyone, but I mean, it's interesting, even like, just reading about like divorces, like, so, like the overall numbers of divorces have peaked, and this, according to what I've read, have sort of peaked and more or less stayed the same, it's primarily like the upper class is getting divorced less than lower classes of people. And so this one sociologist talks about people who talk left but walk right. So they're all open, pronounce a very open sort of progressive ethic, but live very, very conservatively. In some sense, you know, they're at least how they live. They're married, they have kids, they, you know, they're not cheating, all that sort of stuff. And how, like, those people who espouse sort of these other views are actually people of privilege and relative wealth, where divorce is happening more in communities and amongst people who don't have resources and don't have all these things. So I wonder if some of, like, even those things are from people with more... more resource? I don't know. Anyway, Tom's got his hand up again.
Yeah, I'm going to pick up on what you said about
Christian church's response, or the field hospital. I'll first comment that in my experience within the church, either there's been the very, very mum teaching on sex, or the Augustine, shameful sex, only for procreation, or what's the other one? Or anyway, there's been very little teaching on the health of the exuberance of it. Yet, if we look at the culture around Boston, as I understand it, more than 50% of the population of Boston, greater Boston, is either single or divorced. And we have a world that's got, the overpopulation's happening. This issue of birth control, but also just the issue of what do we have to say to a world of adults, half of whom are single? What is the Christian vision? I don't think you can look at item number. I don't think many people are going to buy into item number 6 there. That's just dandy, over half the population. Jesus himself says that was only for the few to whom it had been given. So I'm just wondering, what does the church have to say to a modern culture of broken families, but many people living alone?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question, and I have a few answers that maybe are fairly trite, but I do think churches can come around people and provide some sense of community, or also a picture of being human that's not just about once you get married, or when you finally get married, or when you actually have kids. I'm sure those are all things you've heard. I'd be curious to hear from other people as well. I'm not sure I have the perfect programmatic answer to that.
Asking you to kind of throw the question out there, because I don't see many answers.
Yeah. I think as a whole, like as a culture, we've lost a lot of sort of mediating institutions, spaces that are not not the government and not the person, but something in between that give people like a sense of purpose or a sense of meaning. And I think that's fed into why people are just alone on the internet for hours and hours a day, or on social media, whether they're scrolling social media or finding some like right-wing conspiracy website. Like people feel alone. And it's not just the church that can give them some sort of in-between space where they can meet other people who are different than them and do things with people.
The irony there is around New England, so many churches are tiny. And I have a fair number of friends scattered among many churches, and you see many men and women both wanting to be married and unable to even meet a Christian potential mate.
Yeah, I'm curious if other people have any thoughts on that one. Yeah?
I wonder, you brought up that kind of the nuance of compatibility, mm-hmm. using that as a technological term, I think is interesting. But just the idea of, do we have a wrong picture mm-hmm. of compatibility, like specialization, when you talk about smaller churches, if we don't embrace the value of like multi-generational community? If I can only be friends with people who look like me or my age, my education level, mm-hmm. Like that wrong thinking of this is the picture, and mm-hmm. popular culture, especially rom-coms, movie, this is your soulmate or your match, or you have this weird Disney-esque picture of this one person, and as opposed to being kind of open to people. In that way of not kind of pegging them automatically, but that loneliness of not, if you're just looking for this one person, you're missing out on this whole room full of potential friends mm-hmm. or people that you can serve alongside or learn alongside. Mm-hmm. And that, just that if you kind of push that compatibility, at least that's the idea that kind of sparked in my mind.
Yeah.
We can be applying that wrongly in a lot of ways that kind of blocks us.
Yeah. Yeah. Julie?
So this question is about when you talked about the culture, number three, going back and influencing culture number two.
Yeah.
And how we should be aware that that's happening. And so my question has to do with, do you have some practical suggestions for people today, Christian people, to help us become more aware of that, or to help us to maybe influence back the other way, two to three? Are there some practical things that you could give us to help with that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd also put it open to, or put it out to other people as well, if they've thought of things, but, I think for me, even just sort of being aware of the fact that, you know, as a culture, we're not just sort of, sliding into like this immoral, like, do what you want, but there's like the left has taken, like, sort of the political left, and I hate to just speak in over, sort of generalizations, but or sort of contentious political terms. But yeah, the left has taken a lot of lessons from the religious right in the 90s, I think. And I think they're presenting a moral vision, and they're presenting it like fairly aggressively, you know, and forcing compliance to it. I think simply, for me, just for one, just being aware of that, and being aware that that's just, like, that's the air people breathe. And so that was part of my thoughts, and beginning to listen to people, and before just going and speaking about this, that, or the other thing, or trying to go and influence the culture, but actually listen to people's stories, actually listen to sort of what's animating their own sort of moral vision and listen. But I mean, like, on like an overall practical thing, like step by step, I mean, I don't know if I have answers for like this, that, or the other. I can listen to people and talk to them and hear where they're coming from and try to explain where I'm coming from. But I don't know. I'm always a little weary of like, this method, then do this. I don't know. Is that, maybe that's a cop out on my part, maybe other people, but Sarah, did you want to say something?
Well, I mean, you and I have been talking now for a while about this kingdom without a king phrase. I think it's helpful as even to kind of like hold it out as almost a constant diagnostic of like, do I want the king or do I want the kingdom? Do I want the king? Or do I want the kingdom? Am I doing this because I like being in the kingdom or because I belong to a king? And I wonder, yeah, what it would look like for us in our friendships, in our churches, you know, in our communities, if we just kind of almost force ourselves somehow to be like, do I belong to something greater than myself? Do I belong to someone? Because to me, I think like even you, like, you work your way back up those disintegrations, and I think like the kind of the bottom line of these disintegrations is like sex doesn't matter to anybody except me, if it matters to me, when it matters to me, and to kind of move back up that, you know. And for a reintegration to happen is to say, like, actually, it matters to everyone, or everyone, and it matters to God, too. And this is part of, a way of worship. I guess it's kind of weird to think about it in those terms in some ways, but it shouldn't be, I don't think. So, yeah, I think for me, that's been helpful. Have I lost sight of the fact that there's a king here? Or is it just like, well, this is really nice and comfortable and easy, and it doesn't cost me anything, so I can go about life the way I want to. And again, that's sort of like, it's a way of thinking about your life, but I think that does then help with deeper awarenesses of like, like a disposition toward others and toward how we're living our lives that then ends up having very practical outworkings in our own contexts.
Yeah, I mean, I think two people are, I mean, this is just my impression. I think people are pretty exhausted by the world and fairly confused underneath, I think sort of underneath a lot of like strong, confident opinions on things is a lot of insecurity and uncertainty and hurt. And not to get like all Dr. Phil or, you know, like Oprah. But I mean, I do think a lot of people, you know, it's like, I mean, take him or leave him. I read an interview with Jordan Peterson the other day who said after he's like been listening, he's this, do you know who he is? He's this professor of psychology in Toronto, sort of a controversial person for different reasons. But, you know, he said for years I've been listening to my students and they have amazing critiques and like dead on critiques of capitalism, of the inequality of like our current democratic structures, and they can see through like all this other stuff, but they struggle to get out of bed in the morning. Like they don't see a point. Like they, and like he's realized that people are, I think exhausted, and confused and uncertain. And so I don't have great like practical for across the board things, but I do think beginning to listen to people and hear where they're coming from, and you know, especially this kind of like third culture that is just like can see through everything, very cynical, has this like great Marxist critique that everything's power, which works on everything, you know, but like underneath that, I think people are hurting, and often, you know, underneath that too, I mean, not always, but like, I'll just speak for myself, underneath that or experiencing that culture when I lived in East Vancouver, it's like, these are coming from people whose parents, are paying for part of their rent so they can drink $4 Americanos and work, you know, a couple shifts at a bar a week and, you know, they're interested in writing their first novel. This isn't true, like, across the board. But a culture that deconstructs things is built on, I think, a lot of institutions, that make that life possible and make it actually fairly comfortable. And so even those critiques often come from fairly privileged, sort of powerful people, and I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure that was a super helpful response. Is anybody who hasn't had it? I just was curious before we get to go too far, but yeah, can you remind me? Is it Jeff?
Yeah, Jeff.
Yeah, hey, thanks for coming, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks for the talk. It's very good, Jeff. Just a thought on that too. This is going to sound overly simplistic, but I find that at least where I'm at right now in my walk is that a lot of times it just comes down to prayer. Because I think what's happening here underneath all this is there's a spiritual battle. And that's I know it's like such a simplistic answer, a Christian answer to give, but I think praying, you know, when we see people who are lost, when we ourselves are lost in the third culture, so let's see a way that you overcome, we can overcome with arguments or we can show God's love for the world, but I think just praying for against what's happening spiritually is, I think that's part of our response, for sure.
Yeah.
Is to see it, to mourn the damage. It's so pervasive. I know so many people, too, who have, like, you didn't touch on this, but as I've gotten older, I've met more and more people who've dealt with even just, like, sexual abuse of children. I was just talking to somebody recently who realized they had experienced this. there's like so much stuff going on. I know you probably could have touched on it if you wanted to, but I just can't help but think that's got to be part of our response is praying against it, asking God to intervene and restore some of what was lost, and whether it's bringing us back to a second or maybe it's a fourth culture down the road, it's even closer, you know, really maybe it's God's kingdom. We can get there.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that's true. Like it's people, and wherever you sit, and you know, I wasn't trying to present like first culture bad, second culture great, third culture good. Like people have been hurt through all of these, and yeah, I think you're right. That I mean, I think it's helpful to do things like this to sort of not just like we have a way that a grid that we like look through the world. And we don't reflect upon it very much, but, you know, things like this are like, let's look at how we think about sex as a culture and let's kind of, you know, take it apart. And I, you know, like, we're not gonna win the day by, like, outsmarting people, you know. I think you're right. Like, I think, like, these things happen when we pray, when we listen to people, when we listen to God, and when we try to love people the way we want to be loved, because we're, like you said, we're lost too. You know, like it's I find the world a very confusing place to make sense of. And I don't think I'm alone. But yeah, thank you for that. Yeah. Can you remind me your name again?
Paul.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of, likewise of that, like, what are we to do? It seems like a lot of things that come to mind in terms of that colonizing is of a taking nature, and I was thinking that this could dovetail practically into the theology of hospitality,
absolutely,
which is the inverse of that. It's like instead of taking or retaking, but learning to give could be an answer for both how to address topics of loneliness and how do we remake culture in this day and age in terms of being Christians? What does it look like to be Christ in this culture? But also, like, how do we learn to reintegrate intimacy into things that are not just, you know, not just about sex, but also just about, like, me connecting with another person over coffee, an unexpected coffee.
Yeah. Is that the name of a coffee shop? Or
no.
Okay.
But maybe it will.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Do you have your hand up there? Or?
Yeah. Just tying in some of that too. I think I found what's super important is praying for discernment. And so for you, like, how is this culture influencing us? I think that's where we need an answer from God for and practice. I remember hearing this lecture from a lady a long time ago on. She did a lecture on beauty and how we perceive beauty and how the media, you know, influences us as far as what we think beauty is. And so she said if she was out with her daughter at the checkout line and they see this magazine and it's totally photoshopped, and she'd be like, that's a lie. You know, like, so it's like, it's discerning the message that's coming to you, because messages are coming to you even if they're not written. It's,
yeah.
It's how do you feel, like, oh no, I'm not thin enough and I'm not young enough after I look at this. And that's a lie, you know, you have to name.
Yeah.
And of course counter with what the truth is, but I have found that's really important, and especially if you can do that with people, and you can help each other name things that aren't true, and that really put burdens on us that we shouldn't have.
Yeah, Tom?
Yeah, I heard within the last year I heard a radio show on National Public Radio, probably on point. It was a collision of Culture 3 and Culture 2. I kept tuning out and listening to sports radio, and then I get so bored. But when the sports radio ad, you know, 5 minutes of the ad, they go back to it. And apparently there's a reality show called Bachelor.
Yeah.
I don't have a TV, but I gathered that the women were talking about this. And apparently there's this time when one guy is dating multiple women, and they get to go into the special...
Yeah.
Honeymoon suite and do their thing, And they commented that there was this one weird guy who was a Christian who insisted on not having sex until after he was married. And the commentator said, gee, I can't imagine that. You know, I don't, that's an important part of compatibility, blah, blah, blah. I tuned out. Came back later and they said, they were talking about how many relationships had lasted. I said, well, weirdly enough, the Christian guy's the only guy who's married.
Yeah.
Everyone else had divorced. But weirdly enough, that was their word. Weirdly enough, the guy's still married. The only guy that didn't have sex before marriage.
Yeah, Marty.
Oh, I'm really thankful for what Paul said about hospitality, because that's what I've been thinking, is that in terms of just what everybody has said, but with Christian marriages need to be attractive. They need to be Christian families need to be attractive and open and hospitable. And, you know, it's not like a program that you can top-down program, but I think as we are attractive but real, honest, and have people in our homes and have our friends who are hurting and who are the people who've suffered from this culture, being available to be with their friends and welcome them into our lives.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
It's one of the most powerful things. It's one of the things that's powerful about Le Brie, because people come and stay and they see our families and our families see us enough to know that we're imperfect. And they see our children are imperfect. But they're welcomed in, and conversation about anything is fair game, and including these kinds of issues we're talking about tonight. And so Christians can't just preach about marriages where sex should take place. Our marriages have to be attractive, beautiful, life-affirming for equally for the women and the children as for the men. And,
yes, I would retweet that. People don't. I don't know if people care if it's true, unless they think it's good and beautiful. Like if it does anything for anybody, and if it's compelling. But, anybody else?
Thank you for great.
Did you have your hand up, Dave? Or no?
I think it's sort of been
okay.
Just broadly, we've been talking about sex, but for sure there's a similar underlying human intimacy problem that's probably in bowling alone. And so if you compare the two lines, there's probably similar declines in sexual intimacy and just human intimacy in general. So it'd be interesting to look at those trends, but the things that are being said now about how to remedy some of the human intimacy problem probably gets us closer to a solution. Or not improvement.
Well, you've got the Robert Putnam connection, because you guys share a wall at Harvard. Is that right? No, not really. But you guys, anyway.
Yeah, I don't know if
he's not around anymore. Anyway, Nikki?
I'm really captivated by this idea of the kingdom without a king. I mean, I've listened to
Mark Sayers
for a while. And the whole notion that what is happening is people are looking for a king. And that's sex, that's individualism, that's money, that's power, whatever. But I just feel like the Christian church has a real place in this, mm-hmm. in what it means to invite people to contribute to their lives, like in hospitality, but even in the idea of like Andy Crouch's The Easy Everywhere, that's been a king, and that king is dead. Mm-hmm. Because people feel like they have no meaning and no belonging, no purpose. But the idea of contributing to one another's lives and an actual goal of like friendship. What does it mean to be a good friend? And I think so many of these problems do become less severe when you have friends. Mm-hmm. And to have a voice into the pain of these things. And I think there's been so many things lost with the lack of value of what it needs to be.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, do you have something? Or,
just,
yeah.
One thing we need to avoid is to think we need to jump in with a culture war solution, you know, and to just have the answer. And it's got to be, we've been talking about the last half hour, is one-on-one and informal and broken down and not sort of confronting with a great answer, as if we had the answer for everything. That is actually something from the American Grace book, the next two or three later. He's connecting, he has great respect for evangelical Christians because their quality of life and their commitment to all sorts of good things. But he's, I don't know what he'd make out of the Trump era evangelical Christian scene, which is well after he wrote that book, but there's a lot of sensitivity there of good advice that he could give us
All right. Well, thanks for coming out.